recent survey suggested that there are 7.1 million United Kingdom citizens who have never used the internet, and allowing for that, clearly they might be disadvantaged. In fact, they are disadvantaged when it comes to online billing versus paper billing. To address this very thorny issue, we're delighted to welcome Judith Donovan, CBE. Judith, welcome to the production. Good to speak with you this morning. This is something which I must admit I've been bantering on about for quite some time. Not only for the well-known companies who say, if you go online, you'll make a saving of this, this, this and this. It's actually quite a serious, significant problem we've got here.
It's a very serious problem, Alex, and it's a growing problem. There's a common myth that this is only about old people being very sort of Luddite and not wanting to embrace new technology, and that isn't the case. You know, there are an awful lot of people around Britain actually live in remote rural areas where they don't have any broadband. I live in the Yorkshire Dales. Broadband is very, very patchy, if at all. So many consumers can't take advantage of those offers, even if they want to. We're then getting a lot of evidence to our Keep Me Posted campaign from such as debt charities, who say young people are much more likely to get into debt if they don't have paper statements to help them manage their affairs. It's too lazy to say that this is simply about people who've opted out of the internet because they're old and don't want to change their habits. It's much more complicated than that.
Absolutely right. You are, of course, the chair of the Keep Me Posted campaign. And allowing for that, in terms of, obviously, the knock-on effects of this, you know, computers have a habit of going down and servers create issues and so on. It's not as though we're sort of offering, as an alternative to paper payments, an ideal world where everything works perfectly.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's no such thing as that perfect world, is there? But our campaign, Keep Me Posted, is about choice. We're not anti-digital. If people want to do it online, that's absolutely fine. But we do believe consumers should have the right to choose whether they go online or whether they stay with paper, and they should have that right to choose without being financially penalised. Why should you have to pay to stay with paper if you can't get online, or if it just makes you safer, makes your money better managed?
It's particularly ironic when we look at the communications sector that 7 out of 10 companies actually charge customers more for paper bills. I've always found that quite interesting in its own way.
I think it's very unfair, these service providers, because these are their customers. It seems to be a very funny way of showing customer commitment, customer loyalty, taking the customer with you on the journey, because you're saying is, we don't care about you that much, and we're actually going to make you pay to have that relationship. And you know, Alex, our research showed that 15% of consumers would take their business away immediately if that happened, and 50% of consumers would seriously think about doing so.
And on to the other main provider, 15 energy providers, only 4 of them actually give a clear upfront choice for customers in terms of how they prefer to receive bills. 6 out of 15, of course, offer direct financial incentive to switch bills. It seems as though you've got one heck of a campaign, Judith. I mean, can we see light at the end of the tunnel here?
I don't see why not. If you remember 2 years ago when the banks announced they were going to take chequebooks away, and everybody thought that was a done deal and there was nothing anyone could do, and there was such an uproar that the banks did a complete U-turn and said chequebooks were staying. If enough people get behind us and say, we are fed up with having our preferences taken for granted, we have the right to choose, and we have the right to choose without being fined.
So how do we do this, Judith? Is it a case of we get in touch with your good selves at the Keep Me Posted campaign? What's the best way to actually take action on this one?
Well, certainly have a look at our website, keepmepostedUK.com, because on there there's all sorts of facts and figures and some handy hints about what you can do. The main things we're asking consumers to do is write to your service provider, write to your mobile phone company, your energy company, your bank, your billing society, and say that you support the Keep Me Posted campaign and you object to having that right to choose taken away from you. Write to your MP, write to your local newspaper. The more we get that message out there that consumers should have the right to choose whether they're digital or not digital, and they should not be fined, not be penalised if they want to stay with paper, because it's easier, it's safer, it protects their identity, it gives them more detail.
And indeed also provides opportunities within the letter delivery services, etc., for ensuring that is maintained as well. So one would say it's a win-win situation, keeps jobs in those industries going too.
The postal businesses are obviously changing massively, but they're getting enormous amounts of business from e-commerce, eBay, parcels, Amazon. So they're fine. This is not about protecting post at all. This is about protecting the consumer's right to choose and protecting the more vulnerable members of our society, who are not just the old, the young in debt, the disabled, carers trying to prove their identity under the power of attorney, lawyers trying to prove the identity of their citizens. I mean, any of your listeners who've moved house in the last 3 months, all those original pieces of paper they have to produce to prove who they are for a mortgage. Mm-hmm. This is not about post. This is about paper and proof.
And finally, again, one of those very worrying factors that came out of this survey, nearly half of people without access to the internet are in the lowest socioeconomic groups, with digitally excluded households. We speak, of course of the digital divide, missing out on an estimated £560 on average per year from not paying bills online. That's quite shocking and actually unacceptable, surely, in the 21st century.
Well, I think it's unacceptable because this isn't just about those who can't afford the internet, although we've got a wonderful case history from a pensioner in Birmingham who says, well, actually, I can afford the internet and I use it quite a lot, but actually I might have to give up a hot meal if I was going to do all this extra banking and things like that online. But let's not forget the people who live in the countryside, in the rural areas. They haven't got internet. It doesn't matter how much they want to use it, they haven't got it.
I can see now why you were awarded the CBE, Judith. I think it's only a matter of time before we get Dame Judith Donovan. It's critical.
I'll still be saying keep me posted.
Well, precisely. Judith, two final lines with yourself. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition today?
Definitely.
So can we look forward to hopefully featuring you again in the not-too-distant future and having good news, hopefully, about the ongoing success of the Keep Me Posted campaign?
Tell you what, you write to me, I'll come.
There we are, 11 minutes past nine. Our very own Alex talking to Judith Donovan, CB there, all about the pros and cons of paper billing and internet use and whether we should be doing things virtually or whether we should do them kind of in real life, which made me think. I was talking to my mum about this very issue, actually, last night, quite late on. And I'd met up with an old work colleague earlier in the week who's got one of these new watches, Jeff, that you wear, which is Bluetooth connected to your mobile phone. So you can leave your mobile phone in the kitchen, go and watch television in the lounge, but your watch tells you if you've got a text or an email or a Facebook notification or that kind of thing.
Oh, my goodness.
And that apparently is the latest thing. And, you know, our tech geek, Jonathan, who does the show on a Friday lunchtime, was saying that within 10 years you could be wearing a pair of spectacles and they'll have a virtual screen that you can only see from your side. But, one corner there will be your texts and your emails. And, you know, is this the way that it's going? Is this some sort of information overload? Do we actually need to know things the very second they happen? And if technology is going to go in this way, won't people eventually just say, I've had enough of this?
I think you're right. I mean, sometimes technology can be a step too far. And I think 3D cinema and television is a case in point. I don't think 3D television, at least, is going to take off. And I'd be surprised if there's all that much 3D film in a few years' time, because people can't be bothered wearing the specs. Mm. They can't be bothered to get them. They don't want to be encumbered with it. If you're walking from the kitchen through to the bedroom and you glance and have a look at something, you're not going to be wearing the specs. You're not, and if you don't, the picture looks all wobbly and strange. I don't think it's going to... I'm not a Luddite, despite what...
You've got your tablet there and you're all logged in and wired up, sir.
But I think you can. I think technology can go a step too far, and I think I mean, it's Google is one of the main exponents of the glasses. I don't think it's going to fly, to be honest. It could be. It's got applications. I can see your hands-free, having a screen in front of you for certain tasks could be interesting. I don't know, air traffic control, whatever. Mm. But I think for the general public, forget it.
And, of course, there is one way to do 3D very, very well, and that is just like now. I'm looking at you. You're there. I mean, I think it's the real Jeff. It's not some sort of illusion.
that's what you get. If you go to the theatre, if you go to the Theatre Royal or if you go to the Broadbent, wherever, that's 3D. That's real 3D. That's
real
what we're seeing.
3D. Just like we are here in the studio this
morning. You don't need funny specs. You just need the ones I've got on.
Just use your eyes. I mean, that's what you need. Coming up between now and 10 on the programme this morning, we'll be hearing Alex chatting to Julian Richards. Also, our guest at 9:30 is William Sitwell from Waitrose Food Magazine.
If you're not the one... The former science fiction writer Philip K. Dick was known for thinking we were actually still living in Roman times. There are a whole heap of other activities that often suggest that, well, maybe, we are in the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Addressing that fact in a contemporary notion certainly sort of is at the heart of a study that's revealed today and released today by Total War, Rome 2, reveals a quarter of British adults would vote for the political policies of ancient Rome's maddest men. To put some flesh on the bones of this and begin to address some of the key areas that certainly the report entails as well, who better than indeed one of the fantastic historians and indeed top TV presenters when it comes to matters of historical narrative and so on, the fabulous Julian Richards. How are you, Julian?
That's a wonderful introduction. Thank you very much.
It's the way forward. That's the critical thing for this. So it's headed the Mad Manifesto. What exactly was the rationale behind putting this together? Was it a case of, yeah, Caligula, Cameron, well, they begin with C, you know, who knows?
Oh, that's an interesting comparison. I haven't thought of that one. No, I think it as part of doing the research for this new game, because, you know, there is a huge amount of historical research that goes into them. Mm. The team who were doing it started looking at some of the policies of the emperors, because it's all about, you know, strategy and plotting as well as just battling, and realised that actually there's quite a few of them that if you dress them up in modern language, you know, you remove references to Rome and things like that, then they do seem remarkably similar to modern day policies. So the idea was to create this manifesto and test it out on a 2,000 people questionnaire to see whether people recognised these as ancient policies or how much they agreed with them. And, you know, to me, the results, well, in some ways they're surprising, but in some ways, if you consider that, you know, Roman emperors had got an empire to run, you know, they, and the concerns of the people then were the same as they are today, effectively, in some ways it's not surprising that they resonated so well with people today. You know, there have been some quite surprising results from it, not only in terms of what people voted for, but also in terms of people's political persuasions. You know, there's policies that you wouldn't have thought that if that's their politics, they would have voted for.
Well, if you're allegedly fiddling whilst the city actually burns, Nero's views on tax, abolishing all income tax, well, greeted very favourably, I would have thought.
Surprise, surprise. Yes. The thing is, you know, he did, a lot of emperors did this as a temporary thing. Mm. You know, if you came to power, particularly if you'd come into power through some sort of violent act, then it was a way of sort of appeasing people. You know, okay, we'll have a temporary tax break. And it was terribly popular. But of course, you can't do it on a permanent basis, because if nobody's paying any tax, then you haven't got any money coming in and you can't run your administration. While I can say that that was incredibly popular, although it wasn't the most popular policy. I mean, about 44% of people thought that was a good idea, but I suspect that today people are astute enough to realise that you can't do it on a permanent basis. I mean, the most popular ones, the ones that sort of it really hit the mark with people, was one about increasing trade with foreign allies and providing support to business and industry. Now, of course, that resonates very strongly with our present economic climate,
and
doesn't it?
Augustus at his finest, really, from that perspective.
That was Augustus. Yeah, yes. I mean, Augustus really did come up with, you know, considering when he was emperor, you know, this is sort of at the end of the 1st century BC, beginning of the 1st century AD. You know, some of his policies are very, very far-thinking. Mm. And the other incredibly popular one, which was from Caesar, is about huge investment and repair work in the nation's road networks.
I hadn't quite seen Rome as actually having HS2 or HS1 on the books.
Well, no. I mean, obviously, that's our big debate at the moment, isn't it? You know, do we need that? Or actually, people are saying what we need is an improvement overall.
Straight roads, that was what they want in Rome. Straight roads.
Well, they certainly, you know, if you look at what was here in this country before the Romans arrived, you know, there were communication networks, but nothing like the road network we've got today. And, you know, how many of us today still drive around on what's basically that Roman road network?
Julian, don't get me started on what the Romans did for us. It's a different sign entirely. But, you know, I'm sure we could actually debate long into the evening with respect to that. Clearly, the fictional character Malcolm Tucker is cited with respect to modern politics being an omni-shambles.
Yes.
Half of those surveyed wholeheartedly preferred places in the Roman Manifesto, or policies, I would say, in the Roman Manifesto, to anything served up by any of our current politicians.
Yes. Yeah. Now, does this show a disillusionment with modern politics? You know, I think there is an awful lot, you know, of disillusionment out there, don't you?
Would they have actually been arguing to actually support a war against a possible aggressor, or indeed a situation where you'd actually say, well, we'll throw two missiles in and you can have 250 as we actually invade parts of Syria or do various other things? That's another political issue at that side of things.
But, yes, I mean, that's a very, very hot political topic at the moment, isn't it?
Indeed.
I mean, there's a huge difference between, you know, between Rome and today, though, because, you know, basically who was to say what Rome was to do. You know, there were no laws that they were obeying. If they fancied invading somewhere to pacify it or simply for economic gain, then they did it, because, you know, who was to say no? We live in a slightly different political climate today, don't we?
So the classic line, and I'm not sure it's Sun Tzu and the Art of War who came up with the notion of those who do not learn from the mistakes of history are doomed to repeat it. So that's often a mantra that comes through in a number of authors'
works. I think that's very, very true in so many ways. I mean, you know, you only look at, you know, environmental damage that we're causing, and you can look back and see examples in history of that, and certainly political decisions that have gone disastrously wrong. You know, if people had looked at the history a bit more carefully, they might have realised that some things weren't perhaps that wise.
Don't go there. No. And is this a way in which, obviously, the PC strategy game Total War, Rome 2, which is its full title from that point of view, can that actually sort of help an understanding? I mean, can we see this being used on an educational point of view as well?
I think it does, because I don't think that you can play something like this without absorbing a lot of history. And, of course, what it also does is it enables you to do what historians love doing, and that's playing the what-if card. Mm. You know, if you actually look at something that you know the historical outcome of, but you tweak it, which you can obviously do with this, to say, OK, I won't invade that country, I'll put my effort into this. And, of course, it then evolves in a totally different way. So that lovely question about what would have happened if somebody had done something in a different way, it actually plays out in this. So I think that, you know, these things have got a great educational value because, like I say, I can't see how you can play them and not absorb some of the lessons of history.
Six series of Meet the Ancestors, and of course the classic follow-up in terms of the sort of construction of Stonehenge, and indeed Blood of the Vikings, the five-part series, which I think we need more of from that particular perspective. What is it about what was happening two millennia ago that you found particularly fascinating, Julia?
What was happening at the time?
From your own perspective, what is it? I mean, as opposed to saying, well, no, I prefer the ancient Greeks.
I've always been fascinated with the history of this country and with what happens to us, you know, at the time of the Roman conquest and the Roman invasion, and in particular what happens afterwards as well, because in some ways for us it's a 4th century interlude after which we go back to, we almost revert back to being how we were.
Barbarians.
Before. Oh, no, don't use that.
Don't use that term.
I mean, the Romans refer to us as Brituncule, which means wretched little Brits, which I really do object
you
to
see,
very
even,
strongly.
You see, even in these days of the EU, they haven't changed, have they? You know, it's just the line entirely.
They're fascinating times, yeah. But I just find all of history fascinating, and I'd like to think that by being involved with it and helping to educate people in it, then we can learn some of those lessons from the past and perhaps not make the mistakes again in the future.
Very much so. Well, this is going out, obviously, to our citizens in Lincoln, which in its own way has got a wealth of Roman
history.
It's got a
fascinating history,
exactly,
yes.
From Lindum onwards. And it's been an absolute joy to connect with your good self today, Julian Richards, with respect to the whole piece. We've got two critical questions for you. I feel like I should really ask you them in Latin, but I won't, actually, because
that's a relief.
It's fine. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the Midweek Drive today?
Yes, it's been very interesting.
So,
I really enjoyed it.
Given your historical expertise and presentational expertise, can we possibly prevail upon you to maybe join us again, maybe even come up to the university and talk to some of our students at Lincoln and various other things to share the thoughts?
Yes, I've been up to Lincoln a couple of times to talk to people there, and I'm always happy to come and talk to people about, you know, your history, my history, and my passion for it. So if there's an invitation going, I'm happy to come up to Lincoln.
I think we will definitely sort of set the wheels in motion to get that established, so to
Super.
Speak. As long as it's a straight road, that's the important thing, obviously, from that point of view.
Okay.
Julian Richards, historian and TV presenter extraordinaire. Many thanks indeed.
Thanks very much, then. Bye-bye.
And that's great. That's a wrap. Many thanks, Nat.
Thank you very much.
Oh, that was interesting. That perhaps shouldn't have been on the end there. But yes, it will be a straight route to Lincoln Julian, whichever route you take, the A1 or the A15, you know, a little bit of fog possibly on these roads this morning. But great to hear from you there. And Alex has just popped out for the remainder of the programme this morning. So you've got me, Ed and Jeff with you through till 10 with a gentle wake-up call for a Thursday morning, the 12th of September. Between now and 10, we'll be chatting about food. We're going to talk bananas. I'm going to ask the editor of Waitrose Food Magazine what consumers are looking for between now and Christmas and maybe into the beginning of 2014 to see if our requirements from the supermarket and the deli counter and so forth are changing. If you'd like to get in touch, if you'd like to ask William Sitwell a question, you could text me now on 0779 7800 716. Waitrose Food Magazine, do you know it's comes out every single month, 315,211. It's very precise, isn't it? They are the number of people that read it. William Sitwell is the editor. He'll be joining us in around about 4 minutes.
On 107.3 FM, this is Siren FM.
Wake up with me, Tracy Edges, the Sunday girl, on Siren FM every Sunday morning, 9 o'clock to 11 o'clock on 107.3 or sirenonline.co.uk. Sunday mornings will never be the same again.
Siren 107.3 FM.
And at 9:34 Thursday morning, we are moving from Rupert Holmes and Escape to William Sitwell. And we're going to talk to cider this morning. Good morning, William. How are you, sir?
Yeah, good morning. Very well, thank you.
Excellent. Now, we're just looking at a very fantastic picture of you and indeed your fellow cider maker, Jasper Galloway. Tell us all about it.
Well, a few years ago, Jasper, who's a friend of mine, and Toby Smith, again, who's a mate of mine who lived near us, in three counties actually, Oxfordshire, Buckinghamshire, Northamptonshire. We were chatting about the cider that we make separately because, you know, we always find we have a sort of, you know, a glut of apples come sort of October, and particularly this time of year, and we've all individually enjoyed pressing apples in the juicer, storing it in demijohns, and then bottling it. And we thought, why don't we come together and create our own brand? And so we've launched a brand called the Three C's, which stands for three chaps making cider from the apples of three counties. And we've also, we went and met a group of amazing guys, the Wills family, who are down in Herefordshire, who've been making cider for generations. And they have worked with us so that we've produced a sort of professionally pressed and bottled blend. And it's going to go into Fortnum's in about a month's time. So it's quite exciting. So, you know, all of our families gather.
Mm.
In a few days, over a couple of days, we will in the next month start gathering apples. And we bought an amazing, if you look at, I think you've seen the piece in the Telegraph.
Yeah,
there's a great picture of our cider press that we bought on eBay.
It's wonderful.
And it's, you know, the thing is, it combines my two loves, sort of apples and booze, and the fact that you can make drink from the surplus apples that are just, you know, about to fall off the tree. And so that bit of equipment that you can see is a pretty basic thing. I mean, what you use is it's a pretty sturdy press. We also bought a scratter, which was originally used for sort of chopping up twigs. And what we do is we throw all the apples into the scratter. And then the sort of pulp that you get from that we put into linen bags, which we then stack between wooden boards on the press, and then we use a car jack to sort of squeeze it. And out pours all the juice into a big white bucket, and then we put it into demijohns, and after a few weeks it starts to ferment. And then in order to create a sparkling cider, we then rack it off into bottles and add a little bit of sugar, which then ferments, and then you've got a fizzy fermented apple juice.
It's all very traditional, cider, isn't it? And, you know, in the article I note that cider closing in on beer now, drunk by 7 in 10 adults, whilst the beer market is in decline. Is that really the case?
Yeah, apparently. I mean, there is a renaissance in the cider, and I think that people enjoy the depth of flavour and the fact that you can get quite an interesting range of different ciders. And I think that also the market in cider has been, over the years, dominated by some pretty big brands. There's an Irish one you may have heard of. Mm. But what happens when you have growth and interest in a sector like this, you get smaller producers like ourselves popping up and producing stuff that's great. And it's a very natural British product. And it's a natural, unadulterated British product. And I think people quite enjoy sipping something that literally has come from their sort of, next door field.
It's not got the greatest reputation, though, has it? I mean, we're based in a university campus, and I imagine there's been a fair few litres of cheap cider drunk around here over the years.
Yeah, well, it is stronger than beer. I mean, the cider that we're producing has an alcohol level of about 6%. And, traditional ales are obviously much, much less than that. And if you're used to glugging beer in, many quantities of pints, you do the same with cider and you're going to fall over quite quickly. So I think people have to learn to appreciate cider and drink it a little bit more like they would do wine in terms of the speed in which they drink it.
It's a more intense experience, is it? When we were at the Burley Horse Trials last week, we tried a little bit of cider and it actually gave me a bit of a shock how strong it was.
Yeah, it is strong and, it's closer in strength to wine than it is to beer.
Mm.
And that gives you an idea of the sort of speed in which you should drink it. So, if you want cider as a sort of session cider, so to speak, as a student, you want to glug loads and then pour it over your head and take all your clothes off, then you need to find one which has a slightly, slightly lesser alcohol volume.
Jeff Thompson here, William. I've noticed in real ale pubs, there are quite a few around here, as you can imagine, cider is now featuring quite often at least one, often two or more real ciders. How does a small producer get to market?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it's tough. You have to break through the barriers and just use your powers of persuasion. I think the moment that people can break through the barrier is when landlords are seeing that their customers are asking for this drink. And if they can see that there is a demand out there, they will then start looking at artisanal ciders and so on. Because it doesn't take much to stock a few bottles. But for people like us, I don't know, we have to use all the influence we have, knock on doors, cajole people, bring up anyone we know and try and persuade them. Fortunately, because I work in the food world, I know a few people, so that all helps. But it's like trying to get any product to market. I mean, it does take a certain amount of marketing, PR, and a lot of effort. But we're doing this at a really interesting time. It's a time when there is a renaissance in cider. There is a lot more interest. There's a lot of, I think people are bored of all the, mass-produced gassy beers that all seem to taste the same. If you did a blind tasting of most of the industrially produced huge lager brands, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference apart from the fact that they taste pretty foul and they're unbelievably expensive. There is something quite cheeky about plucking choosing a nice brand of cider from amongst an array of bottles. And also you can of course get it on draft as well.
Well, yes, I was thinking particularly of that because I noticed there's quite a strong regional loyalty where beer is concerned, and I'm guessing the same could apply to cider. If I go to real ale pubs around Lincolnshire or Nottinghamshire, you can pretty much bet at least one of the guest beers, if not the regular beer, will be from a brewery not terribly far away from the establishment.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, people like to patronise the what is local, if it's food, whether it's food or whether it's drink. And, of course, cider apples, generally produced in the sort of Midlands and in Herefordshire, and that is where you get the cider tradition, down in Somerset and so on. And I think that you'll find that people in those areas have a sort of general, a general understanding and a greater affinity with cider. So the job for us is to try and spread that love and that interest of this great drink, further than the areas in which the apples grow.
And I was reading somewhere, William, also that it's been about the best year ever for apples, something to do with the very wet autumn and then the really cold winter and then the warm spring. Apples are in fine fettle, I gather.
They really are. I mean, the cider we're producing is a vintage cider. So the cider we'll be launching this year is the 2011 vintage, because 2012 was a dreadful year for apples. And anyone who has an orchard, anyone who has an apple tree, will know that the fruit was appalling last year. Anyone who's got apple trees this year will know that the apples at the moment are looking good. I mean, it does, you know, we're not quite there yet. I mean, there are a lot of apples that you can pick now, but the most apples for cider will be still on the trees. And, you know, if there is a very, very wet month, you know, it will slightly dampen what could be a glorious year. But at the moment, it's looking very, very good.
And I can tell you from, I do the weather forecast long range on a Wednesday, and the predictions from the Met Office is that September will be drier than average.
Well, there you go, which means that, given the fact we had a very harsh winter, which killed lots of bugs, given the fact we've had this long summer, we've had just about enough rain, if we then have a good dry September, you're going to get a bumper crop. So this will be a vintage year for cider. So, you know, it's a very exciting time if you're into sipping this stuff, or you like crushing apples and making this delicious booze.
And once this delicious booze is bottled, I mean, does it get better with age, or what's the situation there?
It doesn't, to be honest, because you're just capping it. Mm. So you are protecting it from any atmospheric changes, you know, so that you know, I mean, wine, people still argue about, you know, the whole dynamics and the science of wine improving with age, but wine only changes with age if it's got a cork in it, because that does allow a little bit of you know, oxygen to get through, which can then obviously change the structure and the balance of the wine. With modern screw caps, the Kelvin seal, the Stelvin seal, sorry, not the Kelvin, the Stelvin seal, of course, you know, locks in what you've got in the bottle. The reason that you can still get a chlorine, you know, taint, however, from wine bottles, but the idea of wine was always to seal it, you stop it, and so with cider, rather than improving with age, it probably has a sell-by date. And I think that really, if you have a bottle, you should drink it probably within about 4 years. You know, we call ours a vintage cider because we are championing the year in which the apples came off the tree and were at their best. It's more about signifying the year of production rather than, you know, this is a good year to mature, if you see what I mean.
So 4 years, yeah. I'm going to go home and have a word with my mother, because I'm sure she's had a bottle of cider in the cupboard for about 25 years. But I only use a little bit for cooking, she says. You are William Sitwell. You're the editor of Waitrose Food Magazine. It's the magazine where you can find out all about how to cook your favourite ingredients, look for a restaurant in your area, search for tips on better cooking, or find out about how foods are produced. And you've got a monthly readership of 315,211. Most precise. Tease us about your Christmas
we're
issues.
We're bigger than that.
Are you?
Bigger than that. I'll tell you.
Are you?
Our readership is now 2.25 million.
Okay, well, maybe that was my fault, because it says it has a circulation of 315,
yeah,
too. So there you are.
Well, actually, it's just doubled from that, but that's another story.
Okay, so
it is the fastest growing magazine in the UK. It was between January and June this year, but let's not blow our own trumpets.
Well, no, let's, because I was going to ask you to tease us with, you know, presumably your Christmas edition's probably in the bag by now, is it?
I was shooting our Christmas issue with a certain Heston Blumenthal on Tuesday, and we produced one of the most amazing sets of photographs that include my dog Maxton, and you have to wait and see what all that's about.
Very good. Well, you're looking fine and dandy in the photograph in the Telegraph, by the way, William Sitwell. Thank you very much, Steve, for taking the time to chat to us. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
I think you summed that up perfectly. Reasonable, interesting. Yeah.
That's good. And can we look forward to connecting with you again in the near future?
Yes, and ungag Alex. Bring him back. Not that you're great, but he's still a legend. Get him out of the cupboard. Let him go.
He is the man.
Give him some air.
Do you know, I don't even think he can hear you say this, because he's in a meeting. These things will happen, but we will pass on your sentiments. Thank you, Mr. Sitwell.